All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
So we have a really good show today.
Yeah, we have Shahid Buttar, who we are interviewing, who is running against one of our favorite friends of the show, Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi, yeah.
She doesn't know she's a friend of the show.
And he's very well-dressed, so that makes me feel uncomfortable a little bit.
And has a man bun.
Today was Veterans Day, so might hear some percussive sound in the background.
Yes.
There's a parade going by
A parade going by, yeah.
Does that mean you hate America, so that bothers you, right?
I mean, more like I liked America until I couldn't access this building because of some of the parade, so now my politics have really shifted.
Okay.
Before then, I was a big military interventionist, but things can change.
On the way into the building?
On the way in, yeah. No, it is funny. When I was coming here, we were caught behind, you know, barricades. That's not really the word. That's a little dramatic. French Revolution, French Commune.
I mean, they're barricades.
Are they barricades?
Yeah. I guess so.
So we were caught behind them, and I had to sit there, and Born in the USA played, and I'm sure it was not with the intention that Bruce Springsteen had when he wrote that. I don't think it was critiquing foreign policy.
No, it wasn't. No. It was a tribute to Vietnam veterans.
Without like the critique of the thing that got them there in the first place.
That's true. No.
Yeah. And then they started talking. Someone was doing on the bullhorn. They were like, Blue Shield Empire, Blue Shield Blue Cross. Empire was interesting. Am I making that up? It is Empire, right? There's a Blue Shield Empire?
Empire, Blue Cross.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I never.
The health insurance company?
Yeah, yeah.
So so that was mixed up with Bruce Springsteen.
And NYPD, they were giving them a shout out. So it was interesting. Huh. Hate the game, not the player. Hate the military industrial complex, not the veteran.
Right.
What should I say?
Okay. All right. Yeah. I thought I was going to corner you there, but.
So close.
Yeah. You dodged. You dodged.
Yeah, I dodged. I like a draft dodger.
All right. So, what do we have for Republican Suck this week?
For Republican Suck, we have the MAGA Challenge. I don't know if you follow this, but there were some really great videos.
I do in my private MAGA circles. Yeah,
yeah, you do. Well,
thing.
You do watch Dancing with the Stars, which we have to have an update on that. So, who knows what you watch. So, this was a bunch of people like just rapping about Donald Trump, so I wanted to share one with you.
This is a rap about a MAGA hat.
Wait, can we stop?
Yeah.
So this is a bunch of people sort of doing MAGA-themed performances.
Yeah.
Basically, some of them are in their cars and stuff
Yeah, a
like
lot
that.
Of them are in their cars. That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's where they live.
No, okay. Then they should really not support Trump.
Yeah, or, you know, it depends on what kind of car you have, I guess.
Oh, yeah, it's true, yeah.
So what does she mean? This is a rap about a MAGA hats.
Did she say plural?
I think so. Like, can we start over?
Maybe she's like Emily Dickinson style, near rhyme, flat rhyme.
This is a rap about a MAGA hat.
You're right.
The one that always taken by a Democrat.
A Democrat.
A Democrat.
Trump's policies are so grand. Watching the economy expand. So take your friends to a MAGA crowd where the love of freedom is found. Let
them
conform
to
the Trump plan. Ask that Glenn Beck. He's now a MAGA man.
He is? I thought he
is.
Not.
I thought he was an anti.
Yeah, he's a never Trumper.
So there's like fact checking errors. It doesn't agree grammatically. Look, the International Federation of Rap, they're going to call in the airstrike, the rap artist on this thing. That's among the worst rap acts I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But there was a one that wasn't so bad, actually.
Yeah, there was. You want to show
until the
that
very
one?
End, which we should make that caveat.
Oh, so yeah, yeah. Let's see. Here he is. Matt, you like this guy. Nice smile, though.
Right.
Cat on me with the limp, though. Trump 2024, that's a big tempo. Moment that I got it, how to snap it with the camera. Now I beat the case like my boy Brett Kavanaugh. Democrats are tripping, they got betas, they got Asians. Talking about the math, but I guess no one explained it.
Can we fast forward to the end, though?
Yeah.
Ain't complaining. Well, Trump is whipping China deep state in the feds. Donald Trump's the GOAT, tell your family, tell your friends.
That's awesome, with the mic drop and then
the mic drop was my phone,
So I think we should ask our listeners to submit to
their favorites.
If you have your own personal favorite, like MAGA themed rap, you should say, is there
DC the Capitol? That's who that
DC
user is.
DC the Capitol? Is an actual artist, do you think?
Oh, I don't know.
We've had a lot of MAGA themed music in this show.
Yeah, I know. Joy, what's her name? Joy Villa. We got to get her on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it? Hold Your Freedom or something?
Yeah, the one where she had the barbed wire all over.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was fantastic.
Get your freedom. Take it.
and the fetus dress.
Singer Joy Villa is using her Grammy's look to send an anti-abortion message. The star walked the red carpet in a white floor-length Pronovius gown featuring a picture of a fetus.
The fetus dress. Well, you have one of those.
Every woman does.
Yeah.
Somewhere in her closet. It's like an LBD, little black dress. We all have it. We also have an LFD, little fetus dress.
Yeah.
That's like a good rap name. Little fetus.
Little fetus.
That's what I'm going to go by. Little fetus. Yeah. Little zygote.
Little zygote.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the Republican suck.
Yeah. So Democrats suck this week. I think we have back-to-back Elizabeth Warren, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Warren had a very strange confrontation with Amy Goodman at Democracy Now.
It was at a racial justice climate forum.
Yeah. Amy Goodman of Democracy
right,
Now.
Right. Yes, exactly.
And basically Amy Goodman's doing talk about white people.
Talk about her. Yeah. Her famous talk about.
And she's asking about, the question is, should we continue to have the first primaries be Iowa and New Hampshire, since they're tiny all white states? It's a totally legitimate question.
Yeah.
Among other things, even if you're taking the racist element out of it, it's just bad strategy because it produces candidates who don't appeal to the whitest possible.
Right.
So she asks this question and Warren just completely blows up.
It's so weird. Okay, let's go to the video.
Speaking about racial injustice, do you think the order of the primary state should change? You have Iowa and New Hampshire.
Wait, Nate, let me just, before you finish, are you actually going to ask me to sit here and criticize Iowa and New Hampshire?
No, I'm asking about the order.
No, that is what Iowa and New Hampshire.
Let me just ask, they're two of the whitest states in the country. And then we moved to South Carolina with a very significant population of people of color. And it means the candidates spend so much of their time catering to those first two states. Overall, do you think that should change?
Look, I'm just a player in the game on this one. And I am delighted to be in South Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, watch how she says yeah at the end when she shakes her hand. Listen.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened to Liz? Why is she so angry?
So a week after we talked about
big
her
structural
big structural Bailey, what she's doing, she's like this far away from the I am Liz Holio moment.
Yeah, right.
She's you can tell like a lot of public figures have like the simmering rage factor that's just below the
surface.
But
I've never really seen that with her.
Oh, you haven't?
Not really, no. I guess you have.
I mean, I guess most politicians, they all have it because they hate everybody they talk to. It's just a question.
When and where, yeah.
But she's wearing thin a little bit, right? Like, I think...
You think the Bloomberg entrance, like, threw her off or something?
Did they?
I don't know. There's something is coming up. It's very weird. Maybe this was after Amy Goodman asked her if she thought billionaires should exist, and she said yes. And maybe she felt, like, threatened by that question or like it was a gotcha.
Right.
Because Bernie doesn't think they should.
Right.
Not like they should be gulagged, just that they should be taxed.
Yeah.
Although some libertarians probably think that is a form of gulag.
It's just a very strange reaction to have to somebody who's not really being terribly hostile to
you. No, I know. You know the last person who was that hostile on the left to Amy Goodman?
Who?
Bill Clinton. You remember that?
No.
Can I say what some people...
Let me just finish. Now, wait a minute. You started this, and every question you've asked has been hostile and combative. So you listen to my answer. Will you do that?
They've been critical.
Now, you just listen to me. You ask the questions, and I'm going to answer. You have asked questions in a hostile, combative, and even disrespectful tone, and you have never been able to combat the facts I have given you. Now, you listen to this.
He was just very like, that's a rude question, that's disrespectful,
right.
Which is what he always does when anyone says something that's true.
Right.
And
yeah, then he does the...
Yeah.
Oh, is it the this thing, or is it pointing?
When did I say that, and to whom did I say that?
Oh, right.
He did that when he was... when he was busted saying that the Obama campaign played the race card. And the next day, they were like, what did you mean when you said that? And he goes, when did I say that and to whom? No, I'm not going to play that game.
That was good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
When did I say and to whom? It was a little too high.
Yeah.
But and it was on the radio. That's the inconvenient thing about it. He said it on the radio.
Yeah.
Not a good look, Bill. But the Clintons are good at that because they got the vast right-wing conspiracy narrative that they just shove everything into.
Right, but then there's the this is the less than vast democracy now conspiracy.
Yeah, it's true.
It's a very strange thing for her to get upset about.
Yeah. I hope she probably needed to spend some good time with Bailey after this.
Big structural Bailey. Yeah. And the funny thing is that that whole thing blew up.
No
Twitter.
Pun intended.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Blow up doll.
That was really funny.
Yeah.
You did this for a living, right?
I am a punster. My dad is a big punster.
There was a lot of stuff on Twitter about big structural Bailey, and some of them were just the funniest thing that I saw was somebody saying, big structural Bailey wears two pennies on his collar so he can place them on the eyes of his victims.
Oh, my God. That is, who did that? What do we have there?
At zero suit Camus, I guess who it is.
Was this in response to us, or you just found it on Twitter?
No, I just found, there's a whole series of people who are like writing all these things about basically big structural Bailey being like the fourth sign of the apocalypse or something like that. It's very funny, but very weird. So that's a bad couple of weeks.
Did we get any responses to people? Did people agree that this was a Liz Holyoke?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people were doing the hashtag Liz Holyoke, which I think should be a thing. Yeah. So if anybody does a really good Cornholio impersonation,
was pretty good.
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah.
No one else felt what I felt, which was that it was a Dirty Dancing move, which is when Baby gets lifted up by Patrick Swayze. Although I think her arms are like this or like this. Not really like this, but anyway.
It was a great scene.
Yeah. And a great movie.
So what do we have for
Isn't That Terrible? Yeah. Isn't That Terrible is that there was basically a coup in Bolivia that overthrew Evo Morales. Reading from Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman.
Talk about Bolivia.
Talk about Bolivia. Also, when you say something that she agrees with that's very subjective and critical and she wants to be like, mm-hmm, she goes, hmm. Like, David Rockefeller died and he killed a lot of people and supported this coup and that coup. Hmm. So Bolivia is in a state of political crisis after longtime President Evo Morales resigned Sunday following what he described as a military coup. Bolivia has been the scene of weeks of protests since a disputed election last month. Morales announced his resignation in a televised address Sunday. To my brothers and sisters of Bolivia, the whole world, I want to inform you I'm here with the Vice President and Minister of Health that I decided after listening to my friends at CONALCAM and the Bolivian Worker Center and also listening to the Catholic Church to resign my position as president. And this was shortly after the Bolivian military took to the airwaves to call for his resignation. Bolivia's Vice President also resigned Sunday, as did the head of the Bolivian Senate and the lower house. Opposition leader Jeanine Añez, who is the second Vice President of the Bolivian Senate, is claiming she will assume the presidency today. Also, there were like people, right-wingers took over the airwaves. They like attacked people physically to stop them from broadcasting the protests.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a good look in Bolivia. But that's terrible. And then what's extra terrible on top of that, on the isn't that terrible, is you have, not surprisingly, Secretary Mike Pompeo, of course, right, fully support the findings of the OAS recommending new elections in Bolivia to ensure a truly democratic process, representative of the people's will, the credibility of the electoral system must be restored. So this is this huge hawk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who's also evangelical. I didn't know that. He's an Italian evangelical.
Okay.
Apparently
yeah.
they exist. They're, I didn't see them. They were unseen. Hold on.
Wake me up. Okay.
So what's amazing, though, is that we could play a game. Who said it? Pompeo or Clara Jeffrey. Editor of Mother Jones?
Yes, I believe so.
Dicey times in Bolivia. Morales had taken several end runs around a democratic process, but let's hope it is a democratic process that succeeds him. So it's always good when the editor of a liberal magazine named after Mother Jones, who, thank God, is not around to see this, basically has the same line as Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Mother Jones has had an interesting transformation in the last couple
of
years.
She really doesn't like homeless people. She doesn't like people on BART. She doesn't like homeless people in general. You know, she's doesn't like millennials. She's pretty terrible. And so is Ken Drum. Ken or Kevin?
Kevin.
Kevin, yeah.
Yeah, and then she also had Will Menaker, a friend of the show, had a series of tweets posted next to each other where it was basically this, and it was a prior tweet that she had done basically saying that using recycled toilet paper is literally the least we can do to prevent climate change. So as we discussed last week, you know, that's already not the correct position, but basically he's basically
squatting.
Saying this is modern liberalism in two tweets,
yeah,
right? Because
yeah.
The activism is using recycled toilet paper, but then, you know, in reality, it's supporting an American military-backed coup.
Right. So stay Never change, Clara Jeffrey.
That's right. Yeah. Keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? I'm really interested in this new phenomenon of somebody circulates something on the internet that just looks funny, like a video, and it bleeds into the real news process. Like articles get written about it, and then fact checking organizations fact check these videos that have no real meaning or source or anything like that. So, human faced carp found in China became a thing. Have you seen the human faced carp? Here's just a video of this fish that looks like it has a human face.
Does it? Okay.
And it literally looks exactly like the fish from the beginning of The Meaning of Life, the Monty Python movie.
Oh,
so you can see that clip.
Oh my God, it does look alike.
So I almost think it's like somebody
just doctored the video?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so what? Somebody found a carp that looks like a person. And Snopes actually devoted time to do a fact check.
Did they talk to the carp?
Yeah, they didn't talk to the carp. They just scanned it, and they said, based on what we found about similar sightings, however, it seems likely that this is a genuine video of a fish with markings on its head that resemble a, quote, human face when viewed from a certain angle. At the very least, this video is certainly more convincing than this digitally created hoax of a fish with a human face that we covered earlier this year. Apparently, there was another fish with a human face story.
But that was a scam. That wasn't true.
That was more obviously, it's just somebody who did a Thomas the Train face on a fish.
That's so scary.
So it's just funny. I guess now we're doing the same thing. Serious news people are now devoting time to
as
fish.
Serious as useful idiots.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's penetrated serious news when.
Anyway, isn't that weird?
Isn't that weird? Yeah. Great. I like that. We learned a lot. So, by the way, we spoke briefly about sponsorship last week, and it was funny because you came in with a jersey. We didn't coordinate it. And
for the XFL. You already forgot what it was.
The XFL football league, which is a New York-based football league.
Well, it's a national league.
National league.
It's an alternative to the NFL.
Oh, okay. Got it.
It's like Alt-FL.
Right. Alt-FL, yeah. And literally when I was coming in, I was like, oh, I need a hair and makeup sponsor, which I mentioned. And
yeah, I think the same thing all the time. But anyway,
about yourself, though, not me. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of someone had told me about Blink mascara, which it doesn't paint your eyes. It puts tubes on them, which sounds like torture, but it's actually just very nice. So Blink, if you're out there, that's cool. But the irony is that was the one day I put my hair up. And the one day, I'm not blaming anyone in the studio because I think you couldn't see the angle, but I had a very weird thing going on in my ponytail. And
it was the face of Jesus in your ponytail?
Yeah, it was a carp. It was a carp face human or a human face carp. But it was very dry. And it was just in a way, it made a good point because I was really selling how much I needed the hair product and makeup product. So, yeah, anyone, even if you're bad, you have blood on your hands, I'll still take it because I would rather take product from you and it's going towards a good cause and our message is so important, then you give it to someone else who will just...
So you're saying basically that the thing that was going on with your hair last week was an intentional way... It was an effort to try to get a sponsor.
I'm going to recast it as that. Yeah, and it's just funny because it's the one time I put my hair up and then I thought it looked kind of nice.
Yeah, it looked good.
But I don't know if you noticed, there was a crunchy, a dry thing. So I'm going to have to ask the crew to walk around, do a 360... tour of my hair and makeup.
Okay, excellent.
I'm gonna write that into the rider, into the contract.
Well, so we should talk about also another thing from the last show. We discussed
Jeffrey Epstein
and the ABC news.
Amy Robach,
and then that whole fiasco. There's just so many bizarre things that happened with that story.
There was a leak, right, of footage of Amy Robach, which we played last week, where she's basically this ABC reporter who's saying that she sat on the story and wanted to release it, and they wouldn't let her because Prince Andrew's involved, and then they couldn't access the royal family because of that. Then a woman who they said leaked it, her name is Ashley Bianco, she was fired. This is a woman who was a producer who left ABC for CBS, not for any kind of conflict reasons, just for they offered her a good deal. It was 4 days into her job at CBS and she got fired. She was accused of leaking it, and she had clipped the footage, but she didn't leak it. She claimed she didn't leak it. And also James O'Keefe, who's that terrible little man-child at Project Veritas, he says that she didn't leak it. It was someone else. And then an anonymous person wrote something that Project Veritas posted, which is come on, come out. It's I appreciate that you're saying it's not her, but it'd be nice if you could actually take the since she's taking the fall for you,
right?
Maybe reclaim that. And anyway,
yeah.
But hopefully she'll get a gig out of it. She went on Megyn Kelly because, again, the liberals don't let these people talk. So they,
so they
are
all
forced
go to
into the right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that's used to delegitimize them. But yeah. And, you know, really quickly about Project Veritas. So they're terrible. And the reason that one of their most famous scandals was that they got Acorn into a lot of trouble. But what they did was they dressed up, James O'Keefe dressed up as a pimp, and he had a woman with him who was claimed to be a prostitute, a sex worker. I'm sure they didn't use that language. And they walked into a San Diego, I believe San Diego, California, Acorn office, and they said, "Hi, we're looking for a way to smuggle like underage women into the country. Is that cool? Can you help us?" And the guy they were talking to, this guy who was at Acorn, wanted to kind of entrap them, like unofficially entrap them, right? So he was like, "Yeah, okay, yeah, sounds good. Tell me more." And he got the info from them. As soon as they left, he called his cousin who worked for the police force.
Uh-huh.
And he notified all these other people.
Right.
But they just released the video of him saying like, "Yeah, sounds good. You know, you should bring them through Tijuana because that's a better place to do it." They released it to make it look like he was actually a willing participant in this, as opposed to kind of leading like a rogue sting operation.
Right.
And then he did sue James O'Keefe and got like $100,000 in settlement, and he apologized. But that's not a lot of money.
Yeah, carrying charges. Yeah. No, and the whole Project Veritas thing, you know, they're making a living off the dumb things that people say in
right.
media companies because they say them, you
exactly.
know, which is kind
and
of a problem.
Right,
and,
right.
And then, you know, exacerbating everything that happened with the leak, this business from ABC with the Epstein story, is that none of the major sort of media critics on television or any of the cable shows brought it up. It was like there was an omerta about the thing that that came out. So now everybody and his or her brother on Twitter is talking about this, and on social media across the country, they all know about this thing that happened at ABC.
Right.
Because none of the big media companies are talking about it, it just makes them look even dumber.
Right.
You know, I just don't understand that the mentality of not owning some of this stuff.
And Ryan Grimm tweeted, "ABC spiked its Epstein report 3 years ago. If the network bosses don't want this stuff ending up in the hands of James O'Keefe, FFS maybe stop doing this and have the courage to publish your reporting."
Right.
And I would say the similar thing. And also, like, if liberals don't want Project Veritas to be armed with this stuff, then they should be reporting on it.
Yeah,
like,
no.
You know, so.
I mean, yeah. it's this whole business, the media, the fake news and all that stuff, the conservatives are getting so much mileage out of it.
Right.
Because there's an element of truth to it.
Yeah, exactly.
They can't get out of their own way with this stuff, which is crazy.
And then there's a vacuum because the libs don't talk about it. And then they have the monopoly on it, and then the libs who don't want to talk about it use that to marginalize the story.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Really quickly, we just need an update. We forgot to do it last week from another victim from Camp Crystal Lake. Beto O'Rourke
dropped out of the
race, and obviously the world is mourning. But what can you really say about
Beto,
this?
Beto, we hardly knew you.
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody I met in the campaign, another campaign worker, basically summed up the only thing that he's going to be remembered for in this race is the fact that he pointed downward a lot.
Right. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And that if you go back, he says, "This happened," and like that's his way
yeah.
of talking.
Yeah.
And that's,
yeah. He also, when I heard that Beto dropped out, I was like, "Fuck no," because of course he likes to drop the F-bomb.
Oh, that's right.
In fact,
yeah.
I have. Can I play a little short?
Mm-hmm.
Beto O'Rourke's even stronger curse word.
And I was like, "Yeah, what the f-? I mean, I'm running for..."
Delivered with his 10-year-old daughter Molly beside him, caused a fellow Democrat to confront O'Rourke.
"We already have one vulgar in chief. Do we need to replace him with another?
Fuck
Come
you.
On, Beto, clean up your act, honestly."
Yeah, no, great point, and I don't intend to use the F word going forward.
In the past, it was Ted Cruz who used an ad to attack Beto for his language.
Sharing his wit.
How f***ed up is that?
His wisdom.
What the f*** are these guys doing?
And many of Beto's supporters think their guy dropping the F-bomb is da bomb.
Isn't that great?
That's really funny.
Dropping
yeah.
the F-bomb is da bomb.
Wow, that's so Ron Burgundy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
very,
fantastic.
Yeah, she's yeah. very.
I really always love that kind of TV writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic stuff.
And the cadence. Yeah.
Yeah,
is da bomb. Yeah.
Yeah.
He does really go like that better, yeah.
Yeah, so he's gone. I don't know. Is that going to have a palpable effect on the race?
Oh, you know it is, because as you may remember, a friend of the show, Sydney Ember, mm-hmm. who lied this week about people leaving a Bernie speech, but we're going to have to talk about that next time because it'll take too much time to get into all of her lies. But she famously said that Bernie, in one of her pieces that was basically like the thesis of which is like Bernie's ideas are so popular, so he's definitely done. But she said that Bernie was outflanked on the left by Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and Beto O'Rourke.
Right.
Did we talk about this?
No, but I mean, I believe it.
Yeah, yeah. So now he's, you know, now Bernie has the left flank again, now that Beto, you know, far leftist guerrilla Che Guevara fan Beto O'Rourke is out of the race. And now Bernie's no longer in the center into which Beto had pushed him.
We're going to get into this too with Shahid, but it just seems like it's another example of how people who are covering the race...
Yeah.
Like literally have no idea who the voters are.
Right.
Like
yeah.
it's almost like they haven't talked to anybody for decades, you know?
Yeah.
And they're
so contemptuous of, yeah.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah. And they're really good at, I mean, I almost admire how boldly they lie.
Other interesting thing this week, there were a couple of moments. I've been saying for a couple of years now that the prime beneficiaries of the Trump era have been intelligence chiefs and Wall Street titans, because they were both facing cratering popularity heading into 2015-2016. Like, the public was getting really, really pissed at both. We had Occupy, we had the controversy about the NSA surveillance program, and then as soon as Trump came along, everybody forgot that they hated these people.
Right, and they all became rehabilitated, and oh, I'm so nostalgic for the days of George Bush.
Right, yeah, exactly. But every now and then they pop up, and they remind us what it was that we didn't like about
right.
these folks. So Bill Gates had a great moment this week where he was talking about his taxes. He was responding to Elizabeth Warren, basically, and he said this.
And so what would you do?
Well, if you make the tax on capital the same as labor, you go back to the estate tax that we used to have. Doing something like the 10-year thing, you know, where it's super large fortune. The big fortunes are not, as Piketty says, a return on capital. The big fortunes are the return on creating companies that achieve very strong positions, particularly in the technology industry. That's where you get these super big numbers. And so there, you know, I've paid over $10 billion in taxes. I paid more than anyone in taxes. But I... You know, I'm glad to have paid, you know, if I'd had to pay $20 billion, it's fine. But, you know, when you say I should pay $100 billion, okay, then I'm right. starting to do a little math about what I have left over. Sorry, I'm just kidding.
And so he's talking about, you know, how much he'd be willing to pay if Warren's tax plan actually gets done. So that immediately got a response from a bunch of people. And then Jamie Dimon was on 60 Minutes. The Chase CEO, and Leslie Stahl asks him, you know, hey, you made $31 million last year. You think maybe that's like too much money considering you got bailed out and all these other things?
Executive pay. Last year, you were paid $31 million. Too high?
The board sets mine. I have nothing to do with it.
Well, you could return some of it.
I could. Is that going to solve any of those problems?
I don't know.
Is it going to solve any of those problems?
No, but you could set an example, say, I'm not going to take all that money.
Okay.
I don't need it.
I could. I'm going to leave it to the board to set my comp, not you, not the press.
You've answered
my board,
every one of my questions,
my
but this one you're fobbing off.
Yeah, the board has to do it.
Well, let me ask it in a general way.
He's obsessed
with
his board.
Should executive pay in this country?
He's the chairman of the
board.
Of the board,
right,
yeah.
There's that,
so,
too.
You know, that's
well, he
like
really
a,
believes in democracy, Matt, so he wants the board, yeah.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed, and, you know, she could have pushed back on that a little bit. Also, it's so classically Jamie Dimon. Like, she asked him a question, and Jamie Dimon is one of the few people in the world who can't avoid being a jerk for more than like 20 consecutive seconds.
Right, yeah.
Like, if you keep him on any topic
for that long, you can ask him what kind of dog he likes.
Yeah,
or
exactly. Yeah. By the 15th second, he starts looking for a way to like punch you in the face.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. So that is also rocketing around. And it's just terrible optics.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons why, you know, like, we have the politics that we have today, because these people were just so horrible. So
she gets good responses. Remember, she asked Madeleine Albright if it was worth it, like if the Iraq sanctions were worth it, given how many babies died. And she was like, yeah. Leslie Stahl did that. Yeah, that was good. Another
excellent.
Good moment of Leslie Stahl. Yeah.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Just want to clarify something that some people are concerned by. I don't actually want to kill all cats. Should I not cave on that? Is that, you know?
No,
what?
You can cave on that.
Maybe. All right.
No. Don't, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I did feel like maybe that's a bit strong, and people actually wrote to me on Twitter, like, saying that, you know, they were like, Katie, you said how having a dog made you more empathetic towards ants, but what about towards cats? So
right.
my cat aside thing is not real. The sharks is real.
Okay.
I'm sticking to that. And everyone will thank me. Everyone who's ever, if they go, you'll be saved.
If you see a shark, stab it.
If you see something, say stab something.
Right.
If you see a shark, yeah. And really quickly, I just want to say that Sydney Ember, her lie was this. Mr. Sanders' campaign boasted repeatedly about their crowds this weekend, saying he and Ms. Ocasio-Cortez spoke to thousands of people in their 2 days in Iowa. But nowhere was it more apparent than in Carlville on Saturday night, which of the speakers many of them had come to see. As soon as Ms. Ocasio-Cortez finished speaking, people began to head out the door. Okay, I'm sure that was people going to the bathroom. And I'm sure that there were people who are there. You can see the crowds. They don't change. It's not like a dwindling of the crowd. And don't worry, I'm not going to do her voice again.
No, it's like having a railroad spike driven into your ear.
Nails on the chalkboard.
It's amazing.
So if anyone left en masse, it was probably like the press, you know, people like Sydney Ember and like, you know, Jonathan Martin and whoever else was there from like Politico or The Hill or, you know, whatever people who can't stand Bernie Sanders and, you know, call him a cheap Jew, basically. Remember Politico did that? I still can't get over that.
They called him a cheap Jew?
No, they were like, Bernie Sanders is not poor, but he's cheap.
Right.
And they had him standing in front of a tree, a literal money tree.
Fantastic.
A tree whose leaves were bills.
Who needs subtlety?
I know, yeah. And he had three houses, one in each hand and one coming out of his head. It was absolutely amazing. They changed it. They changed the headline. But yeah, I love that.
I guess while we're apologizing for things, I should just take the L on the felony murder thing. I mean, I'm basically wrong in that. In honor of our esteemed guest who was very eloquent on the subject, I'll rethink that.
It was a teachable moment.
It was. It's a teaching moment. So I was wrong. And and so is the rule. So, we have a terrific interview. And let's go to that now.
Let's go to that now. So we're going to bring on our guest, Shahid Buttar, who is running against, he's challenging Nancy Pelosi. He is a constitutional lawyer, also has a background in DJing and spoken word organizing and same-sex marriage legalization.
Excellent.
So yeah, he reminds me of a lot of myself. Yeah.
With the DJing and
the DJing and, you know, influential advocacy.
Excellent. Sounds interesting.
I'm an aspiring jurist, kind of. Okay. So, Shahid Buttar, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. I wanted to make sure that I got the pronunciation right, because there's a lot of overcorrection. You know, people are always like, Chavez. It's like, no, it's just Chavez. But people, so I've heard a lot of people call you Shahid Buttar, but it's Shahid Buttar.
Yes.
Okay, guys.
It's the difference between a martyr and a witness in Arabic. And
oh, really?
I like to say if I have the chance to stick around and talk about it, I would much rather that.
Wow.
So Shahid is witness.
Yes, one who bears witness.
Wow.
And a Shahid is a martyr who sacrifices themselves in the service of a cause. But
no,
I'm not sacrificing
that.
Myself.
I mean, you put a lot of work into it, but not sacrifice. Yeah.
I plan to actually serve in the seat after I liberate it.
Right.
So that's my goal.
Are both names? In other words, are both
as opposed to words.
They're both names, and they're used in very different places. So Shahid is very common in Pakistan, and Shahid is very common in other parts of the Muslim world.
Wow. So, and what about the last name?
Buttar is very unique. It refers to a moon clan, so it's fairly regionally specific to Punjab in Pakistan,
wow.
And it's particularly not widespread, far less common than my first name.
Got it. Cool. Well, so we wanted to, before we talk about your very important campaign in San Francisco, for Congress, we want to talk about a recent victory that also happened in San Francisco. Chase Boudin, who was running for San Francisco DA. Now, to be fair, and you may be excited by this, he did get the Katie Halper Show bump, followed by like an assist from Useful Idiots.
Right on.
So
thanks for that bump.
Yeah, of course. Things are looking really good for you. And Chesa Boudin is the son of former members of the Weather Underground, and they were incarcerated. They were underground. They turned themselves in when he was 14 months. His mom was released from jail after 22 years, I believe. His dad is going to, as of now, die in jail. And he found out that he'd won, because it was like a razor-thin victory. He found out he won on the plane back from visiting his dad in prison. But I wanted to share just a comedic thing, a cute little thing. Of course, he got the Katie Halper Show bump, but also he had a very good spokeswoman named Arlo. So I want to share this video of a four-year-old. This is a girl who I spoke to at a fundraiser for Chesa Boudin on the Upper West Side that his friend Gideon threw. So I thought this would be a cute little.
As DA.
So sorry. It begins with me trying to interview Chesa without any Arlo participation, okay?
As DA.
I want to say something.
Okay.
So, Arlo, can you give us a few minutes?
Why?
You can listen, but because she's trying to record something that other people are going to listen to, you can listen.
Right.
But if you want to talk, you have to wait your turn.
Yeah.
Okay? Then,
okay.
Thank you, Arlo.
Thank you.
When did you get married, though?
When did you get married?
Last question for the candidate.
I'm engaged.
They didn't get married yet. Do you know why we're here today?
Why?
He wants to be...
President?
Kind of. A little bit. Like the president...
But he wants to be the president because Donald Trump is the one we do not like.
That's good.
So
Sammy Five.
That's true.
Yes. We're going to do a game, okay? You have to pretend that you're not here.
Okay.
Because it's going to be a secret that you're here. Because usually
we
wouldn't let people be around us, but because you're special, you can. Okay? But we can't have, the people can't know you're here until later. It's going to be a surprise. Okay? All right.
He will not be eligible for parole.
I'm not talking to you. I was just burping.
She goes, excuse me, I'm not talking to you. I was just burping. And then here's her final analysis. Just so.
Trump always says the wrong things. Like, he makes us say the wrong things. Like, that dad said, like, I don't want to say it, but, like, the wrong words that dad say, like, oh, man, or oh,
So obviously, like, the mom had told her, like, daddy curses because Donald Trump makes him mad. So she was trying to express that. But yeah,
she's
I
an incredible
that was
really, act of intrepid journalism to tease
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, she's
yeah,
really
you just
cute.
Just exploited that child.
I asked the parents.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I got permission. Yeah, but I thought it was so cute, and
but
she
it's
was
kind
like,
of like the way Donald Trump asked. Help from Ukraine. I mean, it was an improper power balance. You weren't really asking.
I know.
Was
I
like
wasn't asking. Yeah.
It was,
well,
know.
Yeah. And the parents really didn't have, they should have waited for her to turn 18
right.
before they got,
right.
you know, and then
she
I
she doesn't have agency
her,
in
yeah,
this situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well.
Okay. Well, so tell us. So we, that would be a good segue into your own very important historic campaign. But Matt and I got into our first on-air fight about felony murder because that is what put his parents away.
That's right.
So what is your take on that? Because we actually said we have to have a constitutional lawyer on to talk about it. So
I'm
since
happy to
you're
be
here, yeah.
Yeah. You know, the felony murder rule is the rule that if you do something trivial in the service of, for instance, like a heist, let's say you're driving the getaway car and someone sticks up a grocery store, and let's say somebody gets shot in the course of that robbery, the person who's driving the getaway car can be prosecuted, convicted, and
right.
serve very harsh penalties for murder. And my attitude with respect to the felony murder rule, first, it blames people who don't commit crimes for crimes that other people commit in the first instance. If we're going to have a rule like that, I would like to see us apply it to intelligence agencies and banks, because if white-collar criminals had an equivalent of the felony murder rule, the entire CIA would be in prison. Everyone at all of the banks that were fleecing people through the 2000s, they would be in prison, but we only apply to powerless people these predatory rules while we have very permissive ones for...
Right. See,
well,
I'm afraid Matt's response is going to be yes, and let's do both of those things.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the thing about that I was saying about the felony murder rule is, you know, if we're going to have somebody who's in jail for a very long time, you know, a crime that results in somebody dying is probably
right. But
you know,
they didn't. But you know what else can happen? You can like drive the vehicle to. Or pick someone up when they go into a house and they're not even armed. And let's say they didn't know the person was at home or something and they grab like a candlestick. So I'm not saying these are not important bad things,
no,
but you know, I do think that.
No, I get the argument against
yeah.
it. I totally do. And,
yeah.
and I'm just saying I understand
right.
both ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I totally, because if you have the for instance, the CIA situation, any felony that anybody would commit and would also be participating in, say, a drone bombing.
Right. Everybody up and down the chain of command.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah.
But now you're making it sound appealing. Now we're for felonies. Murder as a concept, yeah.
My preference, obviously, would be to decarcerate and lessen these burdens, but if we're going to apply these harsh rules, we should apply them evenly. And it is the unequal application of our very harsh justice system that means that we don't have anything resembling justice at the end of the day.
Yeah. Which is the same situation with, like, for instance, enforcing fraud, right?
Totally.
It's like, you know, welfare fraud, they go all the way to the max. They go for people who, you know, who commit welfare fraud. They put people in jail for that. But then you have $100 million fraud, you know, nothing, right? Yeah. It's a settlement.
Totally. Or even to connect those contexts together, to think about a CIA fraud, you know, the war on drugs is a grand elaborate scheme by the CIA in the 90s, right? The CIA admitted to running crack cocaine into Miami and LA. And what we ended up doing was jailing a generation of low-income people of color for participating in a market that the CIA created. Never,
right.
Has never been forced to bear any accountability for.
Right.
But you are here as Shahid bearing witness.
Indeed, and I'm very eager to turn that screw. I want to see executive accountability, not just for our criminal president, but for our criminal intelligence agencies.
Right.
And I'm eager to help defend the human rights legacy that we're celebrating today on Veterans Day while undermining those very same human rights around the world.
It's interesting that you said that because we talk a lot about how things that sound like conspiracy theories are actually true. So the thing about the CIA, for instance, we need a conspiracy button.
Right.
You know, Epstein stuff. Anyway, so, tell us about your campaign. Tell us how it relates to Chesa Boudin's campaign or other kind of insurgent campaigns. He endorsed you. You have a bunch of great endorsements.
I don't know if he's formally endorsed me yet, but
I thought he had. Okay.
I certainly expect that he might.
Get on it. You got the Katie Halperin bump. Pay it forward.
Chase is amazing. And what his victory represents, I think, is that certainly San Francisco, and I think the rest of the country, too. You know, we had very encouraging election results from Virginia, Kentucky, even all across the country. Left-wing voices that are willing to put people before profit and communities before corporations are winning elections, even in places that people wouldn't expect and figures that people wouldn't expect, someone like Chesa, right? And I do think myself, as an immigrant, constitutional lawyer, a Muslim challenging one of the most powerful corporate politicians in the country, in a traditional analysis, I think it just doesn't make sense. But given the earthquake that we are living through, and I think it is as simple as generational transition. Mm-hmm. I have a great deal of confidence. In fact, I don't think Speaker Pelosi stands a chance unless he starts showing up for work. I mean, I don't think you can help the Trump administration as much as she does and still win a citywide election in San Francisco.
Right, right. I mean, talk about the sort of schism within the Democratic Party.
Yes.
I mean, I always saw it as fundamentally being about where the money comes from, right? So you have the party, which has been so dependent for, especially since going back to the 80s when they stopped being sort of reliant on unions and they decided to start taking money from Wall Street and all that. But it seems like they can't get out of their own way in terms of recognizing that problem. And they keep trying to keep the money and somehow keep getting elected, but it doesn't really work, does it?
Yeah, I think of it as almost learning too deeply the lessons of the Reagan era, which just don't apply anymore. You know, Nancy Pelosi came of political age and came to Congress in an age when conservatives very much owned the political system and the political discourse. And we are living in a generation when the center has delegitimated itself.
Right.
And we see that by the fecklessness of corporate Democrats and their complicity in everything from, let's say, CIA torture to NSA surveillance to the mass incarceration, all of the various corporate predatory healthcare system that preys on Americans instead of treating us as people deserving care, racing us off a climate cliff. These are all objects of bipartisan consensus. And the idea that Democrats would be complicit in these ultimately, not even just, I wouldn't even call them conservative because they're not conservative, they are radical, but radically conservative agendas, I think is something that should alarm certainly everyone who has ever voted as a Democrat. And I think there is a predictable response to that that, frankly, long precedes this election cycle. I really locate the roots of my campaign in the Occupy movement. And I would say the same thing for Bernie. I'd say the same thing of Representative Ocasio-Cortez, the entire squad, all of us popping off around the country, I think, are part of a movement that long preceded us. We're part of a movement that will last long after us. I stand on very tall shoulders of others. And part of my job here is to move the movement as far forward as I can inspire as many voices as I can, liberate this seat, send a signal around the country, and then get into Washington to start fighting for we the people of the United States.
Was there one particular moment that this that prompted you to run against Speaker Pelosi?
In fact, yeah, there were two.
Okay.
Both in 2018. So I ran for this seat last year, mm-hmm. and got as many votes in the 2018 primary as Representative Ocasio-Cortez did in hers on the same platform in the same cycle. And so I'm back to finish the job now. And I think it was February 2018 that Speaker Pelosi first, within a period of weeks, she first undermined a proposed surveillance reform
uh-huh.
that I and my former colleagues at the Electronic Frontier Foundation had worked on for years. And then a few weeks later, she did this stunt where she basically filibustered. She read for 8 hours on the House floor letters from DREAM Act students while selling out immigrants in a budget deal. And it was just and so illustrative of her MO, her pattern of looking.
The whole party's really.
Exactly. The whole party's pattern of looking like they're showing up on issues that they refuse to actually show up for.
Right. Being the resistance. Mick resistance, yeah.
Yeah, and reducing resistance to a hashtag. And like, I know what resistance is. I'm an immigrant Muslim who's been fighting the Bush and Obama and Trump administrations just to try to secure basic civil liberties, you know, our own stated commitments in writing. And, you know, and for me, resistance has looked like everything from laying siege to San Francisco for 36 hours the morning after Bush invaded Iraq, done banner drops outside the NSA, light brigades at the White House, you know, music videos that are hip-hop history lessons. I filed cases expanding human rights, I filed cases defending human rights in crisis, in the courts, in Congress, in the streets. And I'm not willing to let resistance be reduced to a marketing slogan for a corporate political party that is going to be complicit in the aggrandizement of the executive branch and the fleecing of the American people.
But I don't know if you saw this. This may change your position. Nancy Pelosi, she gave Trump a standing O, but there was a lot of shade thrown.
That's right.
Apparently.
She can throw a lot of shade by pointing her finger, too, it turns out. You know, this idea of governance by photo ops I find very amusing and interesting.
Yeah.
And as a constitutional lawyer, like, I look at that and I recognize that it is nothing more than symbolism.
Right.
And when resistance is simply symbolic and the road to mass incarceration and mass surveillance and homelessness and mass is paved by the party that claims to be standing with the people, we have a problem, and I'm not willing to be co-opted by that voice any longer.
I particularly like your stance on surveillance. It's always been important to you, and it's equally sort of mystifying to me that it's no longer kind of important. It seems like in the public discourse, you know, quote-unquote liberals or the, you know, media that markets itself to liberals, it's like that issue is like gone all of a sudden.
So many things I want to say. They're first just the way that we even throw around the word liberal.
Right.
Like, liberal used to mean the word means committed to liberty.
Right.
But the people we describe as liberals today, they don't deserve the word.
Right.
I'm a socialist because I'm very proudly committed to a set of ideals that most liberals aren't willing to claim, but they won't even claim their own ideas.
Right, that's the thing. They're not even liberal. Like, I disagree with liberals on things, but there is a coherent ideology there. But these people who we call liberals, like, don't even have that.
They're authoritarians.
Yeah.
And moreover, you know, to think about Pelosi and surveillance, think about the role of the whistleblower in the impeachment inquiry. She's relying on a whistleblower from the intelligence community at the very same time that she continues to kick other whistleblowers in the intelligence community down the stairs. She's insisted on rules that allow protections for federal whistleblowers only outside the intelligence community. And she also affirmatively denies most members of Congress access to staff with security clearance that would give them the opportunity to access whistleblower reports. So she's relying on a whistleblower even as she continues to serve as an agent of executive secrecy.
Right, right. Well, it's the right kind of whistleblower.
Right,
yeah.
So she would claim, I think, yeah.
The Democratic Party has had a lot of positions that I understand because they're getting, you know, for instance, donations from the healthcare industry or from, you know, big tech, big oil, whatever it is. But the surveillance thing I've never really understood. Like, what's in it for the Democratic Party to support the NSA program? And why aren't they making more of a fuss about that? I don't understand that.
So two reasons at least. I mean, one of them is money. There is a lot of money in surveillance. Remember who Edward Snowden worked for.
Right.
He didn't work for the NSA. He worked for Booz Allen Hamilton. So there's a litany, a legion of corporate contractors that are making hand over fist over this. And frankly, they have bipartisan fealties and allegiances. The second piece here that I would note is, I think, and this gets to the co-optation of the word liberal, I think a lot of Democrats look at surveillance through the lens of security theater instead of through the lens of the First, Fourth, Fifth, and 14th Amendments.
Mm-hmm.
There are multiple ways in which surveillance offends basic rights, and it's not privacy that I'm worried about. I'm worried about speech and democracy, because what surveillance means is that even if you have nothing to hide, it means that your vulnerable neighbor who might has to silence themselves. And once your vulnerable neighbors start silencing themselves, we all lose democracy. That's why surveillance is dangerous, because it's democracy killing, not because it exposes anyone. I mean, it does expose people's privacy, sure, and that matters, but it's democracy I'm worried about.
Sorry, I cut you off. Yeah.
Well, just that I don't think Democrats look at it through that lens. They also don't deserve the name Democrats either.
Right, yeah. Corporate Democrats. I heard you on an interview talking about how the First Amendment isn't just free speech, but what is it, like the right to hear?
That's right.
Well, how did you put it?
Could every right has reciprocal rights. So the First Amendment, we think of it as a right to speech. It's also a right to conscience and a right to disseminate your views and gather people around views and petition the government for redress of grievances. There's a professor at NYU Law School, Bert Newborn, who describes it as Madison's music, this set of interlocking rights to participate in a political process. And one of the most bedrock rights in that constellation of rights is the right to hear. You know, the right to speak is not just one that the First Amendment protects. It's a collective right as well as a set of individual rights. It's the individual right to speak in the service of the societal right to include all perspectives. And it is a very important ingredient in the soup of democracy, without which it becomes something very, very different. Right. And unfortunately, we've been hurtling ourselves down that road for far too long.
So you've been a critic of former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper.
Quite.
Can you go through some of that history and what you think that his role has been in the development of the surveillance state?
Appreciate
why
that.
You got arrested.
Yeah. I think I'm the only congressional candidate in the history of the Republic who's both been invited to brief members of Congress and their aides. Representatives Mark Pocan and Rush Holt have both done that on different occasions, and also arrested in the Senate for an act of journalism. So this is 2015. Former Senator John McCain, someone who I know you love very much, was chairing this hearing in the Senate Armed Services Committee. And James Clapper, he was the Director of National Intelligence under the Obama administration, was testifying. And this is 2 years after there'd been a closed, an open hearing in the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon asked this infamous question of James Clapper. He says, is the NSA monitoring millions of Americans? And Clapper, who got the question in writing the day before, answers no, not wittingly, claims a year later that his answer was too cute by half after Edward Snowden proved him wrong by releasing the documents that, of course, show that, of course, the NSA is monitoring not just millions of Americans, but billions of other people, right, quite wittingly.
Right, right.
Leveraging laws that Nancy Pelosi and others adopted and architected. And just to finish the loop on Clapper, after the hearing was over, like any good journalist, I stood up and I tried to ask him a question. And what I asked him, it's poignant to be in New York as we're having this conversation. I asked him, Mr. Clapper, how do you justify escaping a charge for perjury when you lied under oath to the Senate about a grave constitutional offense when Eric Garner was just choked to death in the street in New York? This had happened about 3 months before at the time, without a charge, without a trial, on the mere suspicion of a trivial offense that harmed no one.
What do you have to say to communities of color that are so hyper-policed that we're subjected to extrajudicial assassination for selling loose cigarettes when you can get away with perjury before the Senate? Why is your agency above the law?
And when we have lethal justice without a charge or a trial for powerless people, and we have entirely permissive justice that awards public pensions to people who commit grave crimes against the Republic and then lie about them under a Democratic presidency, right, that was before Trump.
Right.
Right. Yeah. We interviewed John Kiriakou, who was, you know.
Right. The idea that the only person from the CIA, right, who went to prison is somebody who tried to blow a whistle on it, or the fact that, you know, when Eric Garner died, the only person who went to jail was the person who took the video.
Right. Ramsey Order, yeah.
Which Matt wrote about in his book, I Can't Breathe.
I appreciate your reporting a great deal, yeah. And I will say that your piece on John McCain probably 10 years ago was one of my, I love that piece.
He's an interesting subject.
Yeah.
Both Clapper and Brennan, they both gave inconsistent testimony under oath, and you know, there's been no repercussions for it at all. And it feels like that sends just a total message to everybody that there's a completely two-tiered justice system, right? Like, there are people who literally just violate the law on television and nothing happens. And then there's a whole galaxy of other people who, of course, you probably have represented. I mean,
the kinds of folks that Chesa represents every day, and the kind of people who I think, you know, we're all very eager to see the rights vindicated of people who have unfortunately not had the same rights as others. The further piece here that I think, you know, yes, there's the unequal justice and what that means for the powerful versus the powerless, but it also means that Democrats have been entirely complicit in the erosion of democracy that preceded this criminal president. And that's one of the reasons why I think the party doesn't deserve the label, because, you know, the authoritarian party might fit, or the feckless party, or the weak party, the co-opted party. Yeah, any of those things. Right. Pick one. Maybe.
It's kind of both. Yeah. It's kind of authoritarian and feckless.
It's funny. You know, the Thomas Frank's book, Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, that was the first time I really got that. It's not that Democrats are inept. I mean, they are in some ways. And it's not that they're spineless, though they are. It's that they want these things.
Yes.
And they need to pretend that they're opposing them.
Ryan Grimm does a good job of this, too, in his book, We've Got People. I think it's another theme.
Yep, absolutely.
We got Ryan.
Yeah.
We'll get Ryan, yeah.
So as somebody who's opposing Nancy Pelosi, how much abuse do you get? I mean, I feel sometimes, and we obviously talk a lot about this with Bernie, but it almost feels like the vitriol is more intense for like the people who are sort of litigating the schism within the Democratic Party than it is almost for conservatives.
Yeah.
What's been your experience running this campaign?
So the only people who've ever called me Osama in a demonstration, I think, are right-wingers, and that certainly happened.
Yeah.
The vitriol that comes from the center striking left is amusing to me because it makes me wonder what exactly are these centrists defending other than their careers? And that makes sense to me, that they would be really worried about people like me. Right, and the near tangent should, frankly, fear people like me, because they're not going to have jobs after we win our races.
Right,
and you know, I welcome whatever vitriol they choose to bring at
me. FDR and Bernie, I welcome their hatred, vitriol. Yeah,
that's exactly right. At the end of the day, frankly, my experience in the campaign has been the inverse. I get so much support. I can't walk outside in San Francisco without somebody being like, "Oh my God, thank you so much," or "Go beat Pelosi," or "I'm so excited to volunteer on your campaign," or "Oh, I saw you on this," or "Oh, I saw you on that." Riding the bus, if I go running in the park before I make it home, someone will yell, "Beat Pelosi." I mean, it's crazy to me, even around the country. Like, I've been on the East Coast this week doing events, and I think the entire country is over corporate capitalism and certainly the co-optation of corporate Democrats. And I don't think they know it yet.
Right.
The corporate Democrats don't realize that I've already eaten their lunch.
Right.
But I'm eager for the chance to prove it, and I have about a year to do that.
Well, it feels like there's also some of that is a bit of a media illusion. Like, if you ask yourself, who exactly is the constituency for corporate Democrats? It's donors. It's a few. It's a very specific type of sort of upper class, you know, urban person who
it's the
has
Upper
that
East Side, right?
The Upper East Side. But apart from that, who's like the constituent for your constituency is like just people, right? And they're much more numerous, it would seem to me, than the other constituency.
I fully agree.
And but that issue is just not discussed all that much, it seems like, in the press. They always talk about, if you vote for the Democratic Socialist, then you're going to hurt yourself in a general election.
I don't think that's true.
It's not true at all. I think what you're observing is the same reason why, you know, Bernie's relative success in 2016 and certainly remarkable success if we think about the way in which he defined the 2020 campaign's agenda, or Ocasio-Cortez's victory in 2018. I think the media landscape still internalizes those things as surprises, precisely because elites haven't yet figured out that the ground has shifted.
Right.
And we don't live in Reagan's America anymore.
Right.
And I think of this as simply through the lens of millennials are already the largest generational voting bloc in the country. And we know that they're the most progressive generation in the history of the Republic. It's inexorable. There's nothing that the centrists can do to stop the future. And I think they're trying. They're doing everything they can to stop the future, but they can't. They just don't have the numbers. And another way to put this is that, you know, my generation, I'm Gen X, I'm 45 years old. And when I was coming of age, and I think people my age, a lot of us recognized the moral bankruptcy of capitalism, and maybe even recognized, I think a lot of us certainly, the moral bankruptcy of the drug war and many of the other issues that we're talking about, wars for profit abroad, all that. But we didn't have the numbers to overcome the boomers, and we didn't have the resources to overcome the institutions. And as the boomers fade and millennials take their place, that's exactly why I don't think Speaker Pelosi has a chance, unless she shows up for the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and starts working to dismantle mass incarceration and ending mass surveillance. But having architected mass surveillance and having been an architect of mass incarceration, having deferred to health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies that prey on the public to make a profit, having deferred to fossil fuel companies and war for profit that exacerbate the climate crisis, I don't see her showing up for the interests of working families and future generations.
Right.
If she, I would love for her to.
Right.
I would love for her to do her job.
Right.
That would be great. Nothing would make me happier. But as long as she refuses, I'm very right. willing to do the job.
She's so disdainful and contemptuous, too. I mean, the way she talks about the squad, the way she talked last weekend in Bloomberg, you know, she gave an interview saying, I'm a liberal San Franciscan, you know, they don't like me because I'm not a socialist. But basically saying, like, I know it'll pass because I'm in this liberal city.
Well, that's another trick, though.
Yeah,
they
say,
oh, they hate me because I'm from San Francisco, and they call me, like, in other words, they use the disdain of, like, Fox conservatives right. as affirmation that they yes. actually stand
exactly.
for something, but they
right.
they don't always. Right?
Well, and think about where that legitimation comes from. It's conservatives
right,
that are
right.
legitimating
letting,
Pelosi
right,
by calling
frame,
her.
Right, exactly. You're letting them frame the ideological spectrum and political
right.
spectrum.
I want to show some people some San Francisco values. You
yeah.
want to see San Francisco values? They haven't been in the House for 30 years. I will bring the right wing some San Francisco values
right.
if that's what they want to see. And just an example, you kind of shouted this out in the in the beginning. It's also poignant to me to be in New York State, where I had a chance to organize the very first litigation vindicating the right of consenting adults to marry a partner of their choice.
Up in New Paltz, right?
That's exactly right. And people, I think a lot of progressives and liberals will recognize marriage equality as one of the very few issues that we've actually gained ground
right.
on over the last generation. And I'm very proud to have been an early advocate for it. And the principle I would say that that struggle demonstrates is that when you assert, you can change hearts and minds. And it's exactly the lesson that corporate Democrats either never learned or forgot. And it's the reason why Democratic Socialists are sweeping the country, because we are willing to assert that human rights should take primacy over corporate profit. We're willing to assert that peace should take primacy over war profiteering. And I think the American people recognize principle when they hear it.
And I think that's a really important thing you're saying, because I always thought that the Democrats' position on gay marriage was predicated on a misunderstanding of the electorate, right? Again, it was going back to, it's exactly what you're talking about. They're locked in 1980s Reagan America, and they think that that's the paradigm that everybody's living in. But even, you know, as late as the late 90s, if you were on the campaign trail, if you talked to voters, you found that even conservative voters had kind of come around a lot on that issue. And the only way you could not know that is if you literally hadn't talked to people for a long time. Right?
Yeah. I think the Medicare debate and the climate debate both reflect these. I think many conservative people that the media elite write off as unreachable, they all have parents who get sick.
Right.
Many of them have kids who need medicine.
Yeah.
The idea that medicine should just not put you on the street or threaten you with bankruptcy, that will sell in Indiana and Alabama.
Right,
that
exactly,
will sell in every precinct
really
and county across
that,
the country. Yeah. Certainly corporate Democrats don't understand
right,
it,
yeah,
right?
That's, yeah, right. Those people, yeah.
they're also very, you know, in tune on the surveillance issue,
right?
Yeah. They
want to get money out of politics.
Yeah.
Right? Mid-East wars, mass incarceration.
Right.
I mean, there's like, you know, some room to move on some of those issues, it seems like.
It's one reason I describe myself sometimes as a transpartisan constitutionalist. Like, I am a Democratic socialist, and I will.
Right.
I'm eager to establish healthcare and food and housing as human rights. And at the same time, I recognize that there are all these principles that bring together the American people, regardless of our ideology, regardless of our partisan stripe.
Right.
And I think that's the opportunity this moment is to speak to that community of Americans who are willing to see through the contrived dysfunction in Washington.
Which is why I think the kind of contempt for Sanders for going on Fox News is so, where are you coming from? It's like so privileged and out of touch and putting some weird, like it's fetishizing something over the actual lives of people. And if you care about non-Fox News, like forget the Fox News viewers. Like if you only care about the most disenfranchised, and of course I think we see people there are straight white men who are poor and exploited. Like we're not, you know, but let's say you have that very narrow kind of Manichaean view of things where it's like all white people are privileged and all people of color are not. And, you know, you can never have like people of color with bad politics, you know, like even if you only care about those people, you have to reach these other people because we live in a world where we vote and you have to defeat Donald Trump. And it's this weird thing, like with same-sex marriage, we saw that people went out and converted people and they changed hearts and minds. And this contempt towards like, I mean, I know that there's this annoying fetishization of the white working class, but of course we should reach out to them. There's no single policy, show me the policy that throws non-white people under the bus that anyone on the left is pitching
right
to the white working class.
And another way maybe I'd put this is the triumph identity over ideas in the Democratic Party,
right, yeah.
and the willing to defer to demographics to describe people's interests instead of actually meeting them where they're at. And Bernie going on Fox News is meeting conservatives literally where they're at and demonstrating, you know, that was a wild success for his campaign because he demonstrated to that base that he is standing for their interest, even when the people that they think, you know, like Fox News or the president, even when they are not, he is uniquely able because he's actually willing to call out the principal, not do this, you know, moderate gamesmanship, you know, contrivance of a position that they think will survive their false construction of a 1980s America.
Right.
Because he's willing to speak the truth. I think even people who we don't expect to hear it can hear it. And he is uniquely poised to not only beat President Trump in the next election, but to do it convincingly.
Well, he's also focusing on their problems and issues. And not, it seems like the Democrats want, it's almost like they just want to run the same 2016 strategy, just completely talking about Donald Trump all the time and just making it.
They want to run the same people from the 2000s.
Yeah, exactly.
And Hillary's giving her thoughts on Warren and Bernie. It's like, okay, thanks for sharing.
I don't understand why anybody gives her a microphone anymore.
I know.
It's just amazing. Like, she hasn't done enough.
Right. Yeah.
And what about your own?
No, go ahead.
You are for impeachment, but your case for impeachment, more than for it, you kind of demand, and you think that's one of the big failures of Nancy Pelosi, but your case for it is not the kind of centrist corporate Dem case, which talks all about Putin.
Right.
So what is your case for impeachment?
Right, emoluments. So the president has been, even before he took office, profiting from public service. And there is a clause in the Constitution which prohibits it for a reason. It's corruption, full stop, first order. Doesn't take a lot of facts. We have all the facts. It doesn't take a lot of investigation. All the facts are in the public domain. Every time our criminal president takes the Secret Service to one of his golf resorts, we are putting money in his pocket. Every time he invites foreign dignitaries to one of his resorts, we are putting money in his pocket. He's been doing this in the beginning. Every time he puts his name on the side of a building in some other country, right? Or even here in the United States, he's profiting off the brand that his presidency is building. And
A more complicated case, though, because he still has
the branding pieces,
but
bringing people to his resorts is pretty cut and dry.
Yeah, that's prima facie, right? Yeah.
Right, and the vice president has also invited dignitaries to Trump properties, which is to say the emoluments clause gets them both, and it flips votes in the Senate. There is nothing that enrages the conservative base more than the idea of their tax dollars being misused, right?
Yep.
And if the impeachment proceeding was a litany, just an explanation for the American people of all the different ways that this criminal is stealing from you, that will flip Republican votes in the Senate. But a contrived limited process that turns a blind eye to corruption, and we can explore why, because that's an interesting thing in itself, to focus only on a single act, I think is set up to fail, especially when Speaker Pelosi was 9 months late showing up for the process and is now trying to accelerate it to move before the primary elections. You know, we have a limited process. We have a late process. It's a deferential process. And I want to see a real process that forces the president to be held accountable for all of his, not just historical, but his continuing crimes against the republic.
I mean, I think one of the problems that I've had with both the abortive effort on Russiagate and now this Ukraine thing is that it doesn't feel like it's about anything that is connected to an ordinary person.
Right.
Like if it were about emoluments, it would be about something else.
But, yes.
And this is it's an incredibly arcane, complicated story in both cases that where you just keep going farther and farther down the weeds, and it's farther and farther away from anything that's connected to the ordinary lives of people.
And the glaze over the eyes gets deeper and deeper.
Yeah. What's the purpose? Again, the strategy there it seems so strange to me. I can understand a lot of things, but that part of it just eludes me. Like, what's the motivation to go there in particular as opposed to?
I wish I could explain the co-optation of centrist Democrats. I mean, frankly, it is my inability to explain it that drives me to run to replace her because there is no good reason. I can come up with bad reasons, but there aren't any good reasons. The most curious reason, I would say, to bring into this mix is if we were to chase the violations of the Emoluments Clause, I think that the violations might lead us in very interesting directions. And I'm sure that they wouldn't be confined to a single party. Think about, first of all, what President Trump was seeking information about. I mean, just to put the Ukraine thing in context, what we're talking about there is the president inviting a foreign power to interfere in an election, and that is criminal, illegal, full stop, impeachable, yes. But what he was asking for information about was Democratic Party family nepotism and corruption. And that's why I think one reason the speaker doesn't want to look too closely at corruption, and everyone knows it, the American people recognize that our entire political system is up to its neck in corporate money. It's why we don't have Medicare for all. It's why people die every day because they can't get access to the preventive care that they need. It's why we are racing humanity and the earth, the entire biosphere, off a climate cliff. Right. And the only way to get to the bottom of those issues is to get the corporate interests and the money out of politics. I think the emoluments clause would be the most effective way to highlight for the American people all the ways in which that's getting violated. And I do think the fact that these concerns are bipartisan is why I'm here.
That's interesting, because if you did go with the emoluments argument, you'd be able to talk about so many other things that are going on that probably people are only dimly aware of, mm-hmm. right? That would open a Pandora's box. Right. Yeah.
Which is kind of like I don't think I mentioned this last time when we were talking about Epstein, but I think one of the reasons people aren't harder on Trump with Epstein is because they know that it would come back around to bite them in the Democratic, you know, centrist Democratic corporate ass.
Took us.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, thank you.
No question.
Should we ask about what do you think is going to happen in the presidential election going forward, especially in the Democratic primary side? It's so bizarre. Like this is the weirdest primary season that I can remember. I mean, the Republicans last time was bizarre, but this is getting so strange with Bloomberg now and all that.
Totally.
What's going on, and how do you think this all resolves itself?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the question, what's going on? I would describe this as a parade of centrist careerist clowns trying to challenge Bernie Sanders and derail his presumptive nomination for the next presidency. There's no, I think, plausible case that anybody can challenge him meaningfully, if only because he has more donors than all of the other candidates put together.
And
all the polls that suggest that he's in anything other than the front-running position basically systematically undercount younger people. And when you include the entire electorate, he has more support. You see it from the stadiums that he's filling. You see it from the campaigns, like the people who are pounding pavement this far out from the primaries for the campaigns.
Right.
There's no other presidential campaign that has an army of congressional allies around the country like me who are going to be driving votes for Bernie in districts and districts all across the country. People like me in San Francisco, Michaela Wilkes outside D.C., Jessica Cisneros in Texas, Lindsey Boylan and Lauren Ashcraft here in New York City. You know, there is a legion of congressional candidates inspired by Bernie who are part of the movement that includes him. And we are going to, with him and the electorate, when he says not me, us, that's who he means, is all of us together. We are going to win. And no other candidate in the Democratic Party has a we like Bernie does.
Right.
And go ahead. Oh, tracing it back to your campaign, relating it to it. Can you talk about the primary, the jungle primary?
Yeah.
That's right. So the significance of that and what your campaign is about, what you stand for, what issues.
Thank you so much for raising it. The jungle primary system in California is pretty unique. Most people think of primary elections as each party having separate elections and then the top vote getters challenging each other in the general. In California, we put all the parties, all the candidates against each other in the primary election, and the top two go to the general, whichever party they're from. And so in March, when we're choosing Bernie over the centrist clowns, voters in San Francisco will have a chance to select me as the number two to challenge Pelosi in November. And then when we're picking Bernie over Trump, if we haven't impeached him yet, that's when I'll have a chance to replace the speaker and liberate San Francisco's voice in Congress. And some of the issues that I'm aiming to run on, that I have been running on, are securing universal health care. And I want that to be a gateway to expanding human rights to include other basic needs, including housing and food. I want to dismantle mass incarceration and mass surveillance, in which the speaker's been sadly entirely complicit. I want to particularly guard the future and future generations by securing a Green New Deal, expanding the squad, and expanding the voting strength of the bloc that will challenge corporate rule. I'd like to nationalize industries that prey on the public to profit. So that includes weapons manufacturers. That includes potentially public utility companies like PG&E, which is, you know,
got a great one out there. Yeah,
we do indeed.
Yeah.
And we've been pounding a lot of pavement calling for a public takeover of that utility. Mm-hmm. But there are any number of companies, entire industries that prey on the public. Health insurance companies are a good example, right? The business model inheres in paying out less than you take in from people to pay for their health care.
Right.
It's intrinsic to the business
mandatory model. Initial rejections and all that crazy. Yeah, exactly.
One of the components of the Affordable Care Act was this baseline requirement. I think the number was 25% of premiums have to be paid out. Maybe it was 30, but a specified number has to be paid out in benefits. And it's striking to me, first of all, that we need that to be articulated in the first place. In California this year, Blue Cross Blue Shield, who was the company that I was enrolled with, they didn't meet the number, meaning that they weren't even paying out to the public in benefits, the minimum legal required threshold. And this was supposed to be after a legal revolution, right? I mean, the ACA was supposed to be this big thing. And all it effectively did was force people at the penalty of a tax penalty to buy private insurance off a market with no opportunity for public purchasing power to drive down the cost.
Right.
And the whole point of insurance is to drive down the cost with public purchasing power.
Right.
And it's just, you couldn't design policies that are more hostile to human beings if you tried. In the climate context, in the foreign policy context, in the healthcare context, and in all these places, I see capitalism, which is to say the rule by capital over people, demonstrated. And I would much rather see people control capital than capital control people.
Mm-hmm. All right, excellent. Yeah. Well, we wish you luck. That's that's exciting. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Coming from y'all, that means a lot to me. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Shahid Buttar was an early advocate for marriage equality for same-sex couples and a prolific organizer in the movement to end warrantless surveillance. Shahid most recently built a national grassroots network for the Electronic Frontier Foundation as the organization's director of grassroots advocacy. He's been building social movements and speaking truth to power for two decades and graduated from Stanford Law School in 2003. And he's running against Nancy Pelosi, which we love. You can also find out more about him at shahidforchange.us or .us. And you can follow him on Twitter at shahidforchange. Excellent. All right. Make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, because if you don't, Pod Save America wins. The Sharks win.
Right.
The cat feces that kills otters wins.
Pod Save America, sharks, and cat feces.
Yeah, and cat feces, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they're all.
So we lose.
They're all
out
of a piece.
They're all of a piece. They're a trio. They're a thruple.
Right, a thruple.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, they're a thruple, yeah. And
it's
you
the
can,
Holy Trinity.
The Holy Trinity of.
The Unholy Trinity.
The Unholy Trinity.
It's Pod Save America, cat feces, and sharks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
On a pile of dead otters.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And we need somebody to draw that.
Yeah. Yeah. People, please draw it. And you can find us on YouTube. You can find us anywhere. I didn't realize this. Not just Spotify and app and iTunes, but anywhere you find your podcasts.
Your podcast content?
Yeah. All I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I didn't realize that either.
Yeah. So, yeah. And thanks so much for listening.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.